Cultural coverage in the spotlight this week, with a blend of influential writers and a finger very much on the pulse of what's got people talking. Cultural magazines often seem to be running a few steps ahead of the pack. We'll find out exactly how they do it today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. We're leafing through to the culture pages today. With a new president officially taking up residence in the White House, the culture sections of political magazines are certainly feeling the ripples just as much as the front of the book. Later in the show, we'll hear from Monocle's own culture editor, Robert Bound. But first, to New York City. Since its first issue in 1914, the New Republic magazine has been a voice for progressive politics and liberalism. Under new owner Wynne McCormack and editor Eric Bates, formerly of Rolling Stone magazine, the publication is keeping a firm eye on its roots. Michelle Legro is the New Republic's culture editor, and she joins us on the line from their headquarters in New York City right now. Michelle, thanks for being with us on the programme. It's great to speak with you. We're looking at the culture pages, and I guess through a bit of an almost political prism, given all the events that are rumbling on in the US at the moment. Tell me a bit about the culture section of the New Republic. Is it sort of inevitably infused with the political sensibility, and is that sensibility shared across all of the magazine? You know, how do you bring your own editorial touch to proceedings?
So I absolutely think of the culture pages as the New Republic as a place where all of the New Republic, because it's a magazine of politics and culture, we think a lot about the culture of politics and the politics of culture. When we have political pieces, there will be, you know, always want to look at, you know, how is this affecting the culture at large? And when we have culture pieces in the back of the book, I always want to make sure that we're looking at how culture is existing and living in the world we are. So basically, if we are writing about a television show or a movie, we really always want to look at the way that TV show, movie, book, or piece of art is being received in the world. Like, for instance, if we are looking at Planet Earth, the BBC series, that's coming out in the US in a few weeks. So that will actually be coming out during the new Trump administration. So like, we like to look at the political surroundings of any culture event, whether it be a book that's coming out, whether it be a book about, say, personality testing that's coming out, or a book like J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. We like to put them into the political context to make sure that when you're reading it, you're always reading it in context.
And I just wondered, in terms of, if we look at something specific, I don't, maybe like a book review, and, you know, browsing back over a couple of recent pieces, there was a review of Jonathan Chait's new book, looking at, you know, the Obama administration, or Audacity, the name of it, of course. And that's very interesting, because I guess it's a book review first and foremost, but it's also offering a commentary, isn't it? But in a way, I don't know, do you feel there's an extra freedom almost presiding over the culture pages, that maybe people who are explicitly political in their analysis, that they don't always get to enjoy?
Absolutely. We always encourage our writers, even our more political writers and our less political writers, to really dig in and look at how these books are relating to the wider political scene. So something I want our writers to do is take a very strong argument. Sometimes that argument will be explicitly political. Sometimes that argument will be about how politics is affecting culture. So for the Chait book example, that actually was a very interesting situation, because it came out so close after the election. I believe Chait himself actually talked a little bit on Trevor Noah about how he had to rewrite certain portions of it. So we really had to take into account how that book was going to be coming out, because we assigned that book months beforehand, and it would be coming out in an issue after the election. So we had to really make sure that we were very aware of the world that the piece was coming out in.
Well, Michelle, just to pick up on that point, obviously you mentioned the sort of broader context with the inauguration of President Trump, of course, and all of the tumultuous politics we've seen. Well, everywhere, but the States has been no different. Did these processes, and when that sort of narratives are being played out in the, say, in the daily press, for example, does that change your approach? You know, when you have your editorial meetings with colleagues, are you very mindful of that, or do you try and very much stay true to the principles that govern the way the magazine operates, regardless of the political backdrop?
So we are constantly aware of what is happening, because the chatter is happening so fast nowadays. So if you think that you're going to look at a piece and have one single argument, that argument in a day, a week, an hour, may have already been argued out by a huge group of people. You have to be constantly aware that when we sit down to write a piece of the entire conversation that is happening, because our magazine comes out once a month, but we also have discussions happening every single day on the website. So we always want to take the long tail view. This is often a rare view that you, it's such a privilege to be able to take this view, to be able to sit down for, you know, several weeks and have our writers really look at the big picture of what's happening. And that really sometimes means that you have to be aware of what's happening absolutely every single day on Twitter, every single day in the daily press, every single day what's happening in the weekly press, because what happens now sometimes is pieces that come out sort of taking the long view are kind of pieces that look at the past week. To actually look at something over a month, over 2 months, is absolutely what we want to do here. We really want to take the very, very long view, because it's one of the rare opportunities that the press really can do that anymore.
Michelle, let me ask you a bit more about some of the sort of broader curatorial processes then. We've talked about the kind of overarching commitments that the New Republic obviously maintains. What about something, you know, more of a contemporary challenge, I guess? If we look at, say, the print versus online discussions that must take place, how has that changed the editorial process, if it has at all indeed? And what's that discussion like in terms of what you guys think is going to live where and where it can make the most impact?
Well, it's very interesting because as you, you know, we want to have a very full culture base back the books. That means having items on art, that means having items on books, on TV and film. And actually the pacing that's been happening now in terms of like how these things come out and are available to the press is very interesting, because something like the film industry is basically, they're really looking to have someone come attend a premiere, maybe 2 or 3 days beforehand, write up a quick review, and that's it. And then they get there, and then they're able to get their quote, and then they can move on. Our magazine needs to have, you know, at least 2 to 3 months beforehand. And sometimes the pieces that are available are things that are coming out from Sundance, coming out from film festivals, and those kinds of films may actually get a much more thoughtful review because we've really had the time to process them. And also things with television. Now television is coming out not on a weekly dribble, it's coming out all at once. So we really want to make sure that the pieces we have are able to look at really broad trends in terms of like not just how a show like, say, Westworld is coming out, but how it will be received in, you know, 2 months, how it was received as a whole. So it's been very interesting to see, because I think the shift in how culture has been meted out by the larger agencies has a lot more to do with what's happening on the internet, you know, just really getting that quick hit, that quick take. So we really have to step back and often look at several different shows, look at larger trends that are happening in shows. For television, for instance, we've looked at shows that take on modern marriages in society, shows like Divorce and Catastrophe, or shows that look at women and drug culture. So we may have to look at, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 shows at once in order to get a much broader look at what's happening in culture.
Michelle, just to go full circle before we end, we talked a bit about the sort of contemporary political backdrop at the start. Just tell me, purely with your cultural hat on now, away from these tricky media questions, what about the cultural environment in the US post the inauguration? Because a lot of people in this country are saying, oh, well, you know, this reminds us of, I don't know, when Margaret Thatcher was in power, and actually there was some really incredible cultural productivity and creation and expression, maybe of dissatisfaction, but it was a really rich period for culture, even though the circumstances were rather challenging. Do you think that we could be in line for the same in the US, whether it's in art or in literature, that we could be in for quite an exciting time, a kind of ironically, given some of the political challenges?
I mean, I have to say that it is, people are extraordinarily fired up here. I think the thing that people want to make sure is that our new president doesn't suck all the air out of the room, that not everything is about him. We thought about this a lot right after the election was, you know, how do we, he's a black hole into which everything falls. And to not write about culture means that he wins, that he gets what he wants. So we need to make sure that we are both looking at things he is doing, but also making sure that he is not taking up all of our time and energy, that culture is still happening outside of his black hole. It exists now in the America that he will make, but that it is not all about him.
Indeed. Well, we'll drink to that from this side of the pond as well. Michelle Legro from the New Republic in New York City, thank you very much indeed for being with us here on The Stack.
Thank you so much.
This is The Stack. Up next, we'll hear from Monocle's own culture editor, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned.
The Press Briefing, brought to you by The Stack on Monocle 24. After 157 years, journalists at the Norfolk Guardian have lost their base at the high street of the Cheshire town. The staff were moved to the offices of the Warrington Guardian last week, located about 15 miles away. Local Conservative MP Graham Evans says he's keen, if possible, for the weekly newspaper to maintain some sort of a foothold in the town. The National Union of Journalists is also calling for a reversal of the decision to leave the town, saying that a small base in the town would be a great asset for their reporters and would demonstrate to the local community that the paper's owner, NewsQuest, is still committed to Northwich. The publisher of one of Israel's largest newspapers has been interviewed by police for 8 hours. It's the latest twist in an ongoing investigation that's seen the nation's prime minister swatting away accusations of trying to enforce positive media coverage. The questioning of Arnon Noni Moses, owner of the critical Yedioth Ahronoth tabloid, followed the almost daily publishing of leaks connected to the case. Benjamin Netanyahu has accused his critics of attempting to topple his government. And as we reported last week, the longtime managing director of Condé Nast, Nicholas Coleridge, has left his post after 28 years at the publisher. In new announcements this week, current chief digital officer Wolfgang Blau is to take over as president, while general manager Albert Reed will become the new managing director. Coleridge will remain with the company as chairman.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. So, as we've been hearing already in the programme, the New Republic is always careful to keep a finger on America's political pulse. What about here at Monocle? Obviously, we proudly take an international approach to politics, as well as to business, design, urbanism, fashion and more. What about the culture section, though? Navigating all these varied fields could be a tricky challenge, but I'm joined now by Monocle's own culture editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. I mean, you must have surely been on The Stack before. It must be a reappearance, no?
Yeah. I mean, I just come for the fee. and that's why my appearances are few and far between.
I see. It's modest.
Yeah, exactly. The Maserati is idling outside in the Monocle car park.
Let me ask you, now, I often talk about the stack of magazines that the guests have brought in, and there are many, and I'm quite excited to talk about the variety you have. But let's talk actually about Monocle magazine itself first, and the culture pages over which you preside. Because we were talking before, earlier in the programme, about politics and how you, or should you even, try and divorce or separate in any way the backdrop, the political backdrop, from the cultural decision making that you're making. What's that process like for you? Do you think that the attitude, whether it's the internationalism maybe of the rest of Monocle, does that bleed into the culture pages? Does politics explicitly make its way in there? What's that sort of process like month to month?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think if I worked at another general interest magazine, say a weekly, I've chosen The Spectator as one of my magazines to talk about today, the political ideas of The Spectator sort of bleed their way into the culture. There is a sort of way of writing, a sort of small c conservatism that is in those pages as well, which is a nice treat when you read this one. It's got very much its own voice. In terms of Monocle, it's less explicit than that, but a lot of the stories in Monocle could, an affairs story could sometimes sit in culture and vice versa. Mm. In the culture section, there are a lot of stories that we're interested in the business of culture as well as just, this is a good art show, you should go and see it. We want to kind of know, how are those paintings delivered? How much are they worth? Who loaned them? Who's the company that transports the paintings around the world? So we like, as you know, to go into detail on all of these things. So the ideas are a little bit interchangeable in terms of the politics, of course. You can't talk about culture and art and painting and books in a vacuum because they're not created in a vacuum. So in order to be able to critique them cleverly and in the world, you have to kind of, you have to know what else is going on in the world and elsewhere in the magazine.
And I guess even if you talk about that word critiquing, it wouldn't be explicit. So if we were to say, look at how different media models are making a lot of noise, whether it's say on the right or on the left of the political spectrum, we wouldn't just critique them, but we might go and visit them and pick it apart and tour around and see how their model works. So it's a bit more of a, I don't like using it, but it's a kind of a more holistic way of looking at, say, a media model, rather than just saying, are you right? Are you left? Who shouts loudest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we have, in 10 years of Monocle magazine, been to places that we don't necessarily agree with their editorial view. Wouldn't it be great, for example, to do a story on Fox News, especially at the fever pitch of the US election? That would have been a great story to have done. But these are interesting stories. Left and right makes no difference. That's not interesting. What's interesting is the people, is the politics, are the decisions that are made on an editorial floor, are the pizzazz or lack of it which appear in people's writing, the quality of the journalism, and the actual politics, right or left, are kind of secondary importance. I remember a story Steve, foreign editor, did way back at Russia Today, the Rolling News Channel, where he was lectured by one of the presenters about something which clearly was a lie. I mean, it was clearly wrong. And Steve wrote it in a very sort of deadpan, patient way. And I think that is the point, that you can inject yourself into the story, or you can just let someone, you know, you're giving someone a small length of rope with which to hang themselves.
Exactly. And the edifice can come crashing down in a more, exactly, often a more entertaining way.
Yeah.
Well, you already mentioned The Spectator, and I thought, I suppose, in terms of how politics hits the mainstream, it's quite interesting looking at the, I think it's the current edition of Rolling Stone,
yeah,
which, of course, has President Obama, you know, in striking monochrome on the cover. And I guess people would say, you know, well, he's certainly the last rock star incumbent of the White House for a while, yeah, one imagines. But again, it's interesting to look at those cover choices and how they depict the, you know, the big characters around politics.
And Rolling Stone, I mean, for a long time now, of course, everyone's known it as almost as much of a political magazine or a State of the Nation, a Sign of the Times magazine, as it has been a music. And this is the best cover it's had in probably since he was voted in. Maybe he looks cooler now, I think. But that's
he
just
certainly looks more knowing, doesn't he, Barack Obama?
Yes, exactly.
Because he knows what's happening next.
Yes, exactly. He knows what's happening next. He's kind of like, miss me much? Could well be the cover line on that. This is a magazine that I like. Although look how wafer thin it is. This is a magazine I like for its mixture of mixing politics and culture, mixing world affairs and culture, and doing it in an implicit way. Because it's in that magazine under that famous masthead, that beautifully designed masthead, and that sort of famous font, you don't mind whether you're reading about a Neil Young concert or the President of the United States. You treat both those imposters just the same. And I think that's a great and rare talent that magazines have. Vanity Fair also kind of has that talent, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you about this, because obviously, you know, you're culture editor at Monocle, so, you know, you keep across everything, whether it's, yeah, the art market or music, and it can be the big machinations of, I don't know, the big labels or small, the independent scene. But when you're reading or viewing things elsewhere, do you often find actually that the best writing on, say, music isn't necessarily in a music magazine any more, yeah, than the best writing about politics may not be in a broadsheet paper or a journal of record, but actually it could be in Rolling Stone, it could be in Country Life, who knows?
Well, that's one I've got lined up. I think it does, because I think actually my favourite magazine to read criticism in, book criticism or art criticism in, is The Spectator, actually, because it presumes a level of knowledge, but it also presumes you haven't bought the magazine for that. So although you might not necessarily agree with the politics in it, it's for kind of smartish, slightly sort of young fogies or old ones. But it presumes a level of knowledge, but it knows that you probably haven't bought the magazine for that. I find when you read reviews of often movies or records or films in a newspaper, politics have become a lot more explicit in the review sections of newspapers, both left and right, because they're sort of pandering to their readers. And that isn't a great joy to read. So actually reading something about, there's a very good thing about this beautiful issue of Country Life. There's a very good review of a show I saw at the Pallant House Gallery in Chichester. That's the first and only time that art gallery will be mentioned on Monocle 24, let alone The Stack.
Just read me.
But it's nice reading it in this magazine.
Read our listeners the big question. You know, it's not about Trump or the global, you know, existentialism.
No.
What's the big question on the front page of Country Life this week?
So this is the January 11th edition of Country Life, current edition. Cockapoo, Sprocker or Spanador? Which one for you?
And Rob, your answer to that question?
Well, I like the guy on the right. Is he a Spanador?
I'm not sure which one he is.
So that's a spaniel and
he's
a Labrador.
Got real, he's just for so our listeners can do. He's got real sort of come hither face, hasn't he?
Exactly. I hope this might be the picture that comes up with when people click on the stack, because yeah, this is the way to reel listeners in with an absolutely adorable triple puppy cover. I mean, it's like a joke from Total Recall.
But tell me, I imagine there'll be listeners saying, Robert Bounds picked Country Life. What's that about? Well, I mean, why draw that? You know, what draw aside from the winning cover lines of three adorable puppies?
It's a magazine I really like.
What draws you to it, Rob?
It's a magazine I really like. It is in a big city. It's really nice to stroll down the street to our local newsagent and buy this of a week. In the big city, this seems like a little bit of a home to me, being a country boy. And obviously the properties in the front are absolutely fantastic. Sort of property porn is obviously something that we all have a weakness for over a certain age, Tom. We're in that bracket.
Oh, 100%.
And I like that. I also like, as I said, I like reading about things. I like their view on things. There is sort of possibly a sort of metropolitan view of things. And this is sort of refreshing in that it's talking about this, like, quite practical things about, Isn't it annoying when the horse has bolted and you've lost a welly and the man's coming around?
It's a barber jacketed view of things.
And it is for me a hearth around which I can gain warmth and succor.
Love it. Now, you've got a few others. Let's rattle through a couple of others.
So we can go somewhere very far away.
Yeah, what about a bit of an international flavour?
Okay. So I've also picked two magazines from the Brutus stable, Brutus itself and Casa Brutus, which is the homely, sort of cosy magazine. Also some fantastic dog action, Tom, for you.
Great.
In this current edition of Casa Brutus.
You've done your research very thoroughly.
This guy sitting, I don't know what sort of dog he is. He looks a little bit like a dog that might be in a French lady's handbag. Possibly about to eat a slice of foie gras straight from the plate in a smart Parisian restaurant.
That dog's carrying a bit too much timber around him.
He is a bit of a...
He's definitely been raised and placed on that chair.
He reminds
he's
me
not
of
bounded
what
up there.
Kingsley Amis affectionately called his dog, which was the Furry Barrel.
Is that this guy?
He's a bit of a furry barrel. Anyway,
the dog is so fat, it renders it of indeterminate breed.
I
think it was once some sort of... I don't know, is it a pug? It's puggish, but it's just expanded from within. It looks like someone's inflated a balloon inside
it. He's Spanador going on hacky sack, isn't he? anyway, my reason for picking these, Tom, is just that world of, even if you don't understand, it's one of those funny things as well. When you read international magazines, especially magazines in Japanese or Arabic or something that you have no hope of understanding, not a Latin language at all, it's wonderful how much information and charm is communicated pictorially, actually, and how much you can understand and it's a very different idea reading a magazine or just looking at the pictures, actually. And it feels like a guilty pleasure. You kind of go, well, I'm spending this money on this magazine, I can't read any of it. But then you realise, I don't really care.
Well,
I don't know how brilliant
that?
The writing
well,
in
no,
Brutus is. I'll never know.
But there's kind of a clarity of design.
Yeah.
And this would please, I guess, the likes of our creative director, Richard Spence Powell, for example. There's a clarity of design that means you can see the ideas that are being conveyed, even with, well, it's a pretty significant barrier, absolute.
Zero knowledge. Yes, exactly.
But there's a certain clarity of, I don't know, is it of expression or an aesthetic almost? And a lot of Japanese magazines have that, I suppose, to generalise.
And there is this thing, and this was one of the magazines I know that we all looked at 10 years ago when Project Europa became Monocle magazine. Brutus was one of our sort of touchstones because of the amount of knowledge or the amount of information that can be imparted. It is a catalogue-y, it is a completists magazine. It has a nerdiness to the amount of information that it imparts to the reader. I think in English... Or me not being able to speak Japanese, it is a pleasure to behold. I think if I could read Japanese, it would probably just give me... It would be like tinnitus, because it would be so much information, both in words and pictures.
Too
and
much
probably
information,
hate it.
Rob. That's what the young people
too
say
too much
these
information.
Days.
And it's really, really charming. And you just see the world from a very much different angle, a different mindset. And the photography is always beautiful. I always tend to want to live in half the homes that they have in there. It's
absolutely. Okay, you've still got a couple more.
I've got two more magazines.
Let's continue. Right hand or left hand?
Well, I think next to Country Life, why don't we pick Uncut? I like to have... So this is the kind of last of, other than Mojo magazine, this is the last hurrah of the once august, world-beating British music press. This is just great stuff. Long form, reviews. I love to read reviews of things. I'll read the review of a new biro pen when it comes out, because I think reviews are such rich learning. Again, that's something that's fantastic to read in The Spectator. This is just great stuff. Monocle 24's own Andrew Miller often darkens the doors of Uncut magazine very gracefully, and it's just wonderful. It kind of reminds me of why I started loving magazines when I was 14, 15, you know, subscribing to The Enemy and picking up all those old, you know, Vox and Select and these old music magazines that had their pomp in the kind of Britpop era and stuff. This is kind of the last hurrah, and it makes money and it seems to be good business, and it still has, which seems like such a hoary old thing, a free CD on the front.
That's good,
right?
I'm surprised they haven't tried to.
The only place I can play that is in my car.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, so yeah, it's something lovely, and this is a typical kind of Uncut cover freak out. It's Frank Zappa on the front cover, the 100 weirdest albums of all time.
And you know, people are just going to reach for that, aren't they?
Yeah,
on newsstand,
because it's good stuff.
You want to know what's at the top of that tree.
And do you remember when, well, my favourite music magazine of, well, ever really was Word, which was David Hepworth and Mark Ellen's wonderful magazine, now defunct sadly. And it was often said that they were sort of writing and making a magazine for £50 man, that person that would go to HMV or to Rough Trade Records, whatever, and buy three albums and maybe a vinyl and something and a magazine on a Saturday afternoon. That would be a bit of leisure time, and then go home, open a beer and, you know, marvel and listen to and touch all your purchases. And I still feel I kind of miss that, being sort of a younger version of the 50 quid man. I miss that, and I feel that that's something, the Uncut's a great magazine for sort of reminding me of those glory days. But also it feels kind of contemporary, because long form stuff is sort of coming back.
Exactly. Well, let's hope it comes back quick enough to save a few of these august venerable institutions that are clinging on. Okay, yeah. Rob, last one, what have you got for us?
Okay, last and finally is Esquire's Big Black Book. This is kind of, it's possibly nicked a few decent ideas from Monocle itself, from our
surely
forecast
not.
From our forecast and Escapist editions as well. But the photography is really beautiful. It does things really well. It's got naked ladies in it. It's got books. It's got all sorts of wonderful things that I enjoy. It's nicely bound. And I have a couple of mates that have written a couple of lovely things in here.
Great. Month.
It sort of mixes, you know, big Q&As with hip-hop stars, but also having a really nice At Home with Melvin Bragg, which I think is quite peculiarly British. But also, if you're an American reader, you would want to know who this person was, like we want to know who their kind of august figures of the arts are. So that's a good one.
If Uncut's for £50 man, who's Esquire's Big Black Book for?
I think that's the $5 billion man. yeah, that's a sort of nice editorial sleight of hand to bring, I think, essentially, it's the thing that makes Esquire all its money every year, I think, is this Big Black Book and the advertising that it commands. But hey, pays for pints in Blackheath,
pays the bills. Now, Rob, we time is short, so we're going to wrap things up. But tell us, obviously, 10 Years of Monocle, you mentioned it already in passing, and presumably in the coming weeks, there'll be lots more interesting, I don't know, bit of recollections, some thoughts about what the decades meant to you, and indeed where the culture section, as well as the rest of the magazine, heads as we ease on through into 2017. So perhaps we'll be hearing from you again on the Stack.
I hope so.
To chart some of that course in the coming weeks.
I hope so. It's crazy. I mean, it's been 10 years of the magazine. It's been 5 years of the radio station, Tom. We're getting on. It's become a snowball.
It is.
Or an avalanche. Which is the good one?
I don't know. I guess that depends what side of the bed you get out of.
They'll fade me out here and put the Ski Sunday music over the top, probably.
And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our editor, as ever, Claire Urban, and to Rob, of course, too. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop us a note. Fernando can be reached at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday. If you fancy buying some of the titles mentioned on the Stack, including some of Rob's picks for the week, pay a visit to the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's very own newsstand, over in Paddington in London, not too far from where I'm sat right now. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.